You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this episode comes to you live from the secret Welsh festival that we're not allowed to name. This is the absolutely brilliant Mark Watson.
Thank you very much for coming, everybody. I honestly, having just said that, I was about to go, I don't think that's working. so used to mind to doing that. Mark, thank you for coming.
Oh, that's all right.
I'm going to spend the rest of this facing you in a slightly unnerving kind
of
way.
Yeah, the whole layout of the room is sort of odd as well, isn't it? Sort of gladiatorial.
Yeah, but, well, we could do it naked in the middle if you want. Well, maybe.
I thought you'd never ask.
Maybe we'll close like that. So let's start with talking about your show last night. So you did effectively a preview of a show in front of about 250 people.
Yeah, it was. I mean, quite a lot of people at the festival do a show that's labelled work in progress. For me, it was literally the first stab at a new show, although I'd tried bits of it before. But because of the public's enthusiasm for this festival, I ended up with a bigger crowd for essentially a warm-up show than I'd normally get for an actual show, which it sounds like quite an uncharitable thing to do, but I began by saying essentially I wish most of you weren't here, because there were more people than I mean, because the idea of a work in progress show is kind of that you know you sort of stumble around finding the comedy in a haphazard way in front of maybe this many people. This would be a perfect setup for a work in progress. And that was sort of how I imagined it when I signed up for it. It was only on the day that I realised sort of the grandeur of this. It did mean that I had to sort of step up. And in a way, it's good to be challenged in that way. It's just that when there's 300 people and it's a proper venue, as soon as it looks like a proper comedy show, basically, you start thinking people's expectations are already higher than I can possibly live up to.
And were you able to stick to your guns and not fall back on stuff that you knew would work? I mean, obviously, there's bigger pressure there. You don't want to turn off 250 fans in Mac by risking anything.
The last thing I want to do is lose the Mac crowd. Yeah. Well, it was, in a way, it was a bit of both, I think. I'd say that I didn't fall back on any kind of old bits, or there was no actual cheating, but I probably did take slightly fewer risks than if I'd been doing it in this kind of informal setting. The funny thing about a kind of preview, also, it's not even a work in progress towards a show for this Edinburgh, which is what most people are doing here. I'm still doing it in Edinburgh as a work in progress. So yesterday's show was the first step on a path which is at least a year long, so it really ought to have been the most kind of shabby show that I could possibly ever do. As it was, there's something about being in front of that many people and it's the Tabernacle. It was a really beautiful setting, so I probably did. I mean, I don't think I kind of used too many safety blankets, but I did. No, what's the phrase? Safety nets. I don't think safety blanket is a thing, is it? Generally, they don't catch people in blankets when they're walking on tightropes. But I probably did. If it had been a more informal setting, there was a bunch of stuff on that notepad in front of me that weren't even at the level of jokes, that were purely just subjects. And if it had been a setting like this, I would have gone out on a limb and just tried to kind of weave those into jokes. As it was, I sort of... I think when you go into a kind of a preview show, a work in progress, you have a handful of jokes that you know works, you have tried them at some point before. Then there are things that you are confident will be funny, but you're not sure. And that was the level I got to yesterday. Whereas in a genuine work in progress, there's another layer of jokes which aren't even jokes yet. We've just got one word, like bats, on a page, and you speak for 10 minutes about bats. And at the end, you have to say, well, I'll never speak about bats again. You know, that is the sort of liberty you'll take in front of 50 people, which I couldn't really take last night.
It's funny that something really struck me last night watching that show, and it was really interesting to see you do something that was kind of like half work, elements, stories you could go, I can see that this is there, that'll be part of the show, that'll work. Something that really struck me was your ability to just keep talking until something funny happens, and the gap being very, very brief. Like it seemed to me like you weren't ever really in trouble. And I struggle to imagine seeing you take a risk on something like bats and not be able to get something funny out of it.
Well, I've yet to find the funny in bats. considering what funny eyes they've got and all this business with their radars, I don't know. Yeah, the thing is, but there's something funny. There's something odd about bats, isn't there? They can't see, but they can hear incredibly. There's something about bats. Okay, Google bats, you'll find something funny.
What you're doing now is exactly what I mean. Like, you're taking a thing whereby there is no joke, and you're managing to end the sentence because of your relationship with us. You've got this kind of perpetual ability to simply explain the fact that nothing's funny in a way that's funny.
I think I engender a certain goodwill or at least sympathy in an audience. Yeah. Because I think people can see that even before I started talking about specific aspects of my sort of vulnerability on stage, I think people have always been able to see that there are some comedians that make it look very easy. I've always been a comedian that consciously makes it look quite hard. Like, I'm always very open with the crowd about how I feel things are going. I do remove some of the obstacles between the comedian and the audience by being open about that. You know, I'm always basically saying, look, most of you think you can't do this. I also sort of think I can't, but I am doing it. So we've basically got to crack on with this. That is the persona that I put in front of the audience, and that is genuinely how I feel as well. And on the one hand, that probably does mean, as you say, that in a work in progress situation, you get more support from an audience than you might get if you were, these comedians that take a sort of either moral or psychological high standpoint and talk down to a crowd, then I think you have a problem trying new material out, because it's harder to make yourself vulnerable like that. But the flip side is, of course, you've got to be hard on yourself. And I've done work in progress shows, kind of trial shows, that have gone very well purely because the audience is nice and warm and they respond to some sort of need in me. But it doesn't mean the stuff is funny. It just means they want you to not kill yourself. So you've always... Like, last night went you'd say very well by most standards, but that doesn't mean that I've got a very good show. It just means that I've got the ability to go in front of a preview crowd and say, look, guys, help me out here. What's difficult for someone like me is making it into an actual cast-iron good show that will work without all of those caveats. So it's not that I'm that good at always being funny. It's just that I'm really good at making people think, I hope this is funny, I'll help him. And they're you know... And you can do that for 6 months of a work in progress, but there comes a point where you're in front of a real audience that's paid real money, and you have to actually be funny. Yeah.
When you say that there's certain things that people that you're revealing, there's a vulnerability that you're revealing that's honest. Are there elements to your personality that you're actively concealing in your relationship with a crowd, like that confidence, for example? We don't see what presumably in you is the confidence after thousands upon thousands of gigs that you will be able to turn it round. Do you feel like you're concealing that confidence when you reveal the insecurity?
I genuinely don't really have that much confidence to draw on. It's true that as somebody that's done, it will be about 3,000 or 4,000 gigs probably. You do have a kind of built-in set of sensors and tricks, and you have a kind of innate, well, it's not innate, it's learned. You have things to fall back on that you probably do go on stage on one psychological level thinking, I can probably make this work. I think it's a bit like being a sports person. However good you are, you go out into the match thinking, well, I know how to play the game, I know what I'll do if this happens, this happens, this happens, but there's never any certainty that you'll win. And I think what separates at the absolute top level people in sport, from the kind of good but not great, is that they have some sort of ability to think, I will win, I will nail this. And some comedians are also like that. Some comedians are able to switch off what you'd regard as the human faculty for vulnerability and just think, this will go well, it will go well. I don't really have that, and I don't think most people have that. So I'm not concealing any kind of extra superpowers that I have, except in the sense that all comedians are a bit better than they appear to be, because mostly when a comedian appears to be in trouble, there are always more places to go, more get out than there appear to be to the general public, because there are tricks of the trade that you learn. But I don't think you ever feel secure on stage. There are people that certainly do. Someone like Stuart Lee. Well, there are dozens of comedians that are able to go out there, and whether it's going well or not, their basic mindset is, I'm pretty good. I don't have that, and I'm not marking myself out as being particularly frail either. I think a lot of comedians don't have that. So even if a gig is going really well, I don't think you're ever more than about 30 seconds away from thinking something's about to go wrong here.
Are you someone who approaches the writing of a new hour with a sense of fear and a sense of, oh God, I've got to come up with another hour? Or are you, or a tour show, or however long the duration is? Or are you someone that goes, right, I'm going to start writing now and something will come?
I used to approach it with more fear, because I used to do it every year, a new Edinburgh show every year. That would become a tour show every year. And for 5 or 6 years, I was in that pattern. And I think probably most comics have had this experience. There comes a point, maybe about 4 years into that process, where you think, nothing much else to say here. No, funny things can't happen to me at the rate I need to get there. And that is generally a sign that it's time to take a year away from Edinburgh. These days, I'll do a year in Edinburgh and on tour, and then have kind of a year off. So I'll allow myself basically twice as much time as I used to generate a new show, which means that I don't now feel much pressure, because I can allow the kind of themes and preoccupations of the show to take shape fairly naturally. If you only have a year to do it, and expect the thing with the way the comedy year is kind of configured is that if you do, if you began the show here, as quite a lot of people are, then you took it to Edinburgh, then you toured with it until, say, through the autumn, January, February, you might then go to Australia. Suddenly it's April or May, and Edinburgh comes again in August. It's just not really enough time, but there's only so many hilarious misunderstandings that can occur. And also your basic mindset has only got so many different angles to, you know, it's fine for your first 2 or 3 shows. If you're 6 or 7 shows in, like me, you probably won't have a new concept for a show every year. Some people don't mind about that, because they just literally do an hour of stand-up every year. But I'm very different from some people in that regard. There definitely are comics that do approach it by thinking, I need an hour of stand-up, I'll sit and write an hour of stand-up. And I've never been able to do that. I've always pieced shows together by coming up with things over an exhaustive number of shows. The only way I can generate material is to do gigs and see what works. Whereas there are people that, like, I never write anything down at all, other than the absolute minimum of notes. And I'm astonished and envious that some comedians can, like, go into a writing room and come out with a block of material and then try it out. For me, it's hundreds of disparate gags, which gradually kind of coalesce into a show.
And I think one of the tropes of your stand-up is that you referred to it there a couple of times. I think you referred to it on stage last night as well, as wandering around the world waiting for funny things to happen. One of the tropes of your stand-ups is kind of, you know, an unusual thing happened, like I was mugged, or I lost my passport, or I wasn't sure about a thing. They're kind of story-driven.
Yeah, and there's a finite number of those that can happen to you, especially if... Lovely to hear the word trope, by the way. It's been a long... I'd say it, not since my English degree have I heard that.
Wait, mate, we'll start unpacking stuff in about 5 minutes. Hell.
We can't be that far away from dialectic. I'm trying to be less like that. My early stand-up was pretty much all based upon, the reportage of vaguely funny incidents, which I would then exaggerate and stuff. And it still is to some extent. But I now try and have more courage about... Like, last night's show is based on this passport incident, but I out of that, I tried to get kind of a bunch of subjects to talk about, which sort of... It's just too loud to ignore completely. But... I think we both felt we could get away with that for a bit.
I was fairly sure.
Yeah.
I know who's sitting over there, and I was hoping it was going to be either Josh or Tim Key, who were as much of a, and they're both just totally stony-faced. Not me, mate.
Yeah, but if that was your phone, you would be stony-faced, wouldn't you? Yeah. It's basically a poker game now. So what you want to watch for is someone putting the phone off. If they've not managed to do that surreptitiously, there's a danger this could happen again. And on the second ring, it does tend to get interesting, I find. So, yeah, I tend to, these days, I try and actually think, what do I want to talk about, and go for that, rather than reacting to stuff which happens. Because there's only so many times you can be mugged or want to be mugged, really.
Yes.
The mugging, which in my second show was all about a mugging, and it, in terms of, like, when you balance the short-term expense of the mugging, both financial and psychological, against what I got out of it, I'd be mugged every week if I could always get a shout out of it. Because out of that one mugging came a 10-minute story, which became a centrepiece of my live set, and a whole show came out of that. And it's one of the most successful bits I've ever had. And I only lost about £20. There was a knife in my face, but I mean, most comedians I know would basically be done by a crossbow if they got that much material out of it. So, I suppose the point is, if you want to be any sort of a decent comedian, you can't just go through your life thinking, will a funny thing happen on the tube today? At some point, you have to find the courage to dig for subjects that you're actually interested in and find ways to approach them. That's what I'm trying to do after 7 shows.
Staying with the stories for the moment, have you always, when you said to exaggerate them for comic effect, would you... do you always need to retain an element of truth? Is that important to you?
I would have to, yeah. I've seen people tell stories on stage and you instinctively know none of this is true at all. I don't think I could quite do that. I'm not sure I could sell a story that was pure fiction. Generally, and I think this is probably similar for most comics as well, I'll generally start with something which does happen and then just take it in a direction that's more entertaining than reality. Or tell it exactly as it did happen, but just try and find some comedy in the way of describing it.
And what kind of, when you say try and find some comedy in that way, what sort of tactics are you using? Are you trying to, like, people talk a lot about Jeopardy, you know, about kind of, are you trying to make things more important in order to find the jokes? Are you trying to find what's really going on in the story? Are you trying to unearth a truth in it? What's your angle?
Well, I think, and again, this is probably true of quite a lot of comedians, when stuff does happen which has a funny... potential funny side in real life, I generally don't find the funny side at the time. So, for example, I've got this joke. I had a joke in the past show about being ID'd in Marks and Spencer's, and the person would say, have you got any proof that you're over 18? And I said, well, yeah, I'm in Marks and Spencer. And I tell you, it was bloody funny at the time. And that was a real staple of the last show. That was a joke that always... and so that did happen, but I didn't, of course, have that rejoined at the time. What happened was the bloke said, have you got any proof that you're over 18? And I frustratedly thought, clearly I'm over 18. I'm in Marks and Spencer's. My life obviously is going down a path which I'm not comfortable with but not able to resist. I'm sliding inexorably into sort of middle age. I have children. All these things were sort of running depressingly through my head. It was only when I got home and thought, I tell you what would have been funny if I'd said that. And... So I think a lot of the ways that I spin comedy out of the stuff of life is to tell the story as I would like it to have been played out, or say the thing that I would have liked to. Which again, most people are familiar with that feeling of like, oh, I wish I'd said this. I wish the story ended like that. As a comedian, you do get to live those scenarios, but I can only really use them as comedy if they are reasonably close to the truth. As I say, you'll sometimes see someone tell a story that's just 100% bogus. A way you can often tell is they'll say, I was in Brixton and someone said this to me, but then you see them somewhere else, like you see them in Australia and they say, oh, I was in Sydney the other day and this happened, and you think, this is remarkably often this incident that occurred in your life is, and then you kind of know that it didn't happen at all, because if they're able to lie that fundamentally, that it probably didn't happen. I'm never able to go more than a couple of degrees away from the truth, at least as a premise, because otherwise you're just sort of lying. And I think it's got to be attached enough to real life in order for me to sort of believe in the integrity of it, I think, yeah. Yes.
And I felt last night that there were more jokes, there were more punchlines at the very ends of stories, more kind of story resolutions, which were... What am I trying to say? That they were...
Shit?
No, not at all. That they were based not on the event that happened resolving in a funny way, but the laugh came from the description, the language you were using. Do you see what I mean? Did you see the difference between something like, you know, the person didn't fall down the hole at the end of the joke, but they avoided it, and you described it in such a way that that's where the laugh hit.
Again, you pretty much have to evolve those skills, because people fall down holes disappointingly seldom, I think. If you wait for a funny story to happen in front of you, you're going to be waiting a long time. Or, well, this is the thing. There's comedy in pretty much everything that happens. Like, every tube journey has some sort of potentially amusing situation in it. But you do have to... In the end, you're mostly relying on your own interpretation of it to actually mine it for comedy, I think. And I'm increasingly aware of that as well, because there are just more observational comics than there ever have been. Mm. When I was starting... If I told, which is not that long ago, I've been doing it for, I suppose, 12 years. But even then, if you told a story about the going on the underground, there's a crazy person next to you, it was still relatively new ground, at least by the... Today, there's almost no awkward situation that somebody like me, a person with a relatively comfortable life, a white, well-educated... Any situation that I delve into for humour will have been covered... and will be being covered simultaneously by dozens of people. So it's now more important... to find your own voice, your own way of phrasing things, I think, because the actual pool of material or drawing on is being shared by an enormous number of people.
So this is Mark. We had a wonderful show together. What an interesting man. What an interesting conversation. I think he is, well, as you'll hear, we get right into the, I mean, as you've already heard, he's very... sort of stricken is maybe the word, with anxiety and sort of issues of self-belief, as are we all. But I think Mark articulates them better than most, and certainly articulates them on stage better than most. His show, his work in progress show the previous night, absolutely blew me away. He's so, so naturally funny. But like Nina Conti in last week's episode, episode 119, there is something still, isn't there, in people who are unquestionably good and lauded and professional and making a decent living, who still have the ghosts in them, who still have the dark voices going, oh, you're not worth it, you shouldn't be doing this. It's crazy and constantly fascinating to me. So more from Mark in just a second, and we're going to listen right to the end. We're going to get stuck into Mark's reaction to some of Stuart Lee's material being about him. Many of you in the UK will know that in the last few years, brilliant comedian Stuart Lee has started to address other comedians and their habits and their marketing and advertising and so forth, not to mention their material, in his material on stage. And I've been wanting to talk to someone about what it feels like to be on the receiving end of that from someone that they presumably were a fan of, or are still a fan of, or were at some stage, but certainly grew up being very impressed by and very inspired by. And we get stuck into that shortly. So more from Mark in just a moment. I had a couple of very interesting emails I wanted to mention, and a little plug as well. I'll do the plug while I remember. Bob Slayer, he of Heroes of Fringe, is doing a new venture at Edinburgh this year. Constantly innovative, Bob Slayer. I have to say, no matter your feelings on a man who may well have drunkenly jumped onto you at a comedy festival at some point, you cannot fault Bob's ingenuity and innovation. He is doing he's got a double-decker bus. Christ, I know. I mean, this ends in disaster. Surely he's driving off a cliff now. I'm sure he'll be fine. It's called the Blunderbus, which I don't like the spelling of it, but it did occur to me he's done it deliberately so that it's uniquely Googleable, and it's paid off. It's B-L-U-N-D-A, Blunder. Bus, B-U-S, B-L-U-N-D-A-B-U-S. The Blunderbus is Bob's latest Edinburgh venture. It's a venue. It's going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe this year, and you can go to blunderbus.com, and you can support it on Kickstarter and in numerous other ways as well. So I mentioned to Bob, I'd mention that. I think he's a good egg that needs things mentioned. So there's that. Now, emails. I had an email from a listener called Matt Whitby, who opens... vividly enough, I never laugh at jokes, so laughter interests me, he said. That's an interesting opening gambit. Would you say non-comedians laugh at jokes in a different way to comedians? Do comedians essentially laugh at the technical ability of the joke rather than its inherent funniness? Now, I know my opinion on that. I'm interested to hear your opinions. I do think comedians laugh in a different way to comedians, or maybe at a different time, or maybe we appreciate things. Maybe it's true of comedy fans rather than comedians. Maybe if you've got 10,000 hours of watching comedy under your belt, maybe you're going to recognise the same patterns and tropes and rhythms that a comedian would. Maybe there is some extra magical ability that gigging yourself gives you to read and interpret other people's jokes. Certainly Patton Oswalt in his brilliant autobiography, which is called something about Silver Screen. I'll find out for you shortly. But I'm reading that at the moment on my Kindle, and that is, in fact, it's almost certainly on Audible. And remember, if you go to Audible, you can go to audible.com/CC for Comedians Comedian. And I think I get a couple of quid. I mean, I don't know what it is. I think it's £5, but it can't possibly be. It can't be £5, can it? Anyway, have a look on Audible for Patton Oswalt's latest venture. And if you're going to buy it and get a free trial, then maybe I get a pound. Maybe I get 5p. Who knows? But in this book, Patton Oswalt says that there is a particular type of laugh he recognised as a young comedian, which was the laugh of other comedians, which is kind of a barked, ha! At the back of the room. And I've certainly heard that myself, and I've certainly laughed that laugh myself. So what that laugh means, though, is another question entirely of whether it's simply a recognition of something that I wish I'd thought of, or whether... I mean, I suppose the comedians that I really laugh at... Comedy's about surprise, isn't it? I'm forever saying this. Something's got to be satisfying and surprising. That's not my concept, but it's one to which I adhere. And I think when you are a professional comic or watch as much comedy, and when you're involved in the craft of comedy as we do, and as we are, then I think that you recognise things, so it's much harder to be surprised. So that's my answer. But you can email info@comedianscomedian.com, or you can tweet me @ComComPod with your own thoughts on that. Do you think non-comedians laugh at jokes in a different way to comedians? And if so, is it just at the technical ability? It can't just be at the technical ability, surely. But anyway, interesting question there from listener Matt Whitby. Thank you for that. I'm fascinated by your opening sentence there, Matt. I never laugh at jokes, so laughter interests me. Let's assume you're not a serial killer of some sort. I mean, I you're probably a very decent, regular guy who just never... I mean, never... Never laughs at jokes. Fascinating. Let's hear from you at home as to what you think about that. And another one, and this, I mean, this was beautiful. We'll deal with this very quickly. This is from Adam Morrison Jones. He sent me a tweet that simply said, "Been doing stand-up 2 years today, thanks to ComCom. Thanks, man." Well, thank you, Adam. That put a huge smile on my face. I mean, these days, as you know, I'm far less interested in pulling up the ladder than replicating the ladder on a 3D printer and beaming it around the world to people's homes, thus giving everyone more ladders. So I'm so thrilled, Adam. Thank you. I'm very glad you're doing stuff. I mean, maybe you're terrible. Who knows? But the simple fact that you're out there doing a thing and that you attribute that, at least in part, to this show makes me extremely happy. Thank you very much. We will do, in shows to come, maybe I'll think of an appropriate hashtag and we'll do a little sound off for anyone that reckons that ComCom helped them in there. I know I've got a running tally in my head. We're under 20, but it's still, we're in double figures of people who started a result of this podcast. So yeah, keep at it. Keep at it, all of you. That's almost everything. If you'd like to support the show, if you'd like to donate, of course you can do that at comedianscomedian.com. You can click on the PayPal button and specify your own choice of donation. Now, I mean, we're on 120 shows now. Probably a pound a show is getting a little bit out of everyone's range. What do we say? 10 pence a show? What's that? 12 quid? 12 quid's a reasonable donation, isn't it? If you've listened to every single one, you could probably throw 12 quid at me. I think the show's worth 20, but that's my basic idea of like a drop, a street performer's drop for something that you've shared a bath with. If we've shared a bath together, I think it's, or a marathon, I think 20's a reasonable donation. But seriously, whatever you feel you can afford is, I'm enormously thankful for. I've had some, I will read at random now, some names of people who've recently donated. Alice Matthews has donated, not for the first time, I don't think. Matt Fraser is a name I think I recognise. Julia Harrison, Paul Francis, Tom Jones. I mean, there's got to be lots of them, but let's hope it's him. Ian Jackson. Vaughan Yabsley has donated several times as well and is blessed with a very memorable name. Catherine Skillings, Hugh Marsh, Vivian Riddick. Vivian Riddick is probably my most frequent donator. And thank you to all of those names. If you would like to be on that roll call, then you can donate via PayPal at comedianscomedian.com, or you can press some cash into my hand and say something cool. Now, on that subject, I told you that story last week of being at the Welsh Festival, about whose name we never speculate, and Darren Hubbard pressed some cash into my hand. It was very kind of him. I told that story recently on my first official proper telly job, which was on Dave Channel. It's Alan Davies, As Yet Untitled, and it's coming out in autumn. So I'm not sure of the exact date, but I'll try and keep you posted. And I don't know whether they'll let me keep that anecdote in the edit, because obviously it explicitly refers to and consequently slightly advertises the podcast. But I did tell the story about Darren pushing the cash into my pocket at a urinal, and it made Matt Lucas laugh. So I'm happy with that. We've got to be happy with that, whether it makes the edit or not. That's all for now. You can also, of course, if you're on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/comcompod. Let's get back now to the brilliant Mark Watson.
Do you feel that you were part of a vanguard, almost, of people who were changing comedy from...
I've got a badge, yeah.
But you see what I mean? Like, I feel that you really popularised the kind of reportage story, finding funny things in a thing that happened, rather than, you know, basically what I'm saying is I see a lot of older comics bitching on Facebook, or I used to in the last 5 years.
Yes, I thought
years,
that was what you meant.
Older comics bitching on Facebook the fact that, you don't need to do jokes anymore. You just need to talk about a thing you did.
I think the time that I came through in the same period, it was like the newcomers, but me, Rod, Manford, Russell Howard, and it definitely was about that time that people started saying, oh, you don't need jokes anymore. So I think I was sort of accidentally was part of that kind of... I mean, no one ever consciously tried to create a movement of jokes not being valid anymore. I think... Because for me, obviously, it's the only way that I could approach it, as it was for... Actually, Manford is a slightly different case, but certainly people like me and Russell were just... I don't think that I was actually part of that, though. I would say it was already happening, because there were a bunch of comedians like Dara, Chris Addison, who came along maybe 5 years before me. And when I first went to Edinburgh and was watching stand-up, thinking, right, so this is how you do stand-up, those people were already doing that. So I'd say the swing towards anecdotal comedy happened sort of in the late 90s, and I was, as a punter, was influenced by it. So I reckon I'm sort of second generation, not vanguard. I reckon I'm standing on the shoulders of... So I just briefly thought of standing on the shoulders of Dara. That'd be wonderful.
And do
he'd
you
feel so powerful if you're on his shoulders. He's such a might. Carry on. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
I just wish one time I could get on Dara. But yeah.
And do you ever recognise... I suppose this is the same question, maybe in a different way, is do you
a
ever...
A great big beast of a man. Yeah, no, carry on. Yeah.
Do you ever recognise any of... Or did you ever recognise any of your style in people that came after you? Do you think there were elements of things that you did that were influential?
Well, no, I don't think that I've been sort of... enough of a figure to influence anyone, really, because I think I would say that because basically Kitson's career runs not quite parallel to mine. He was around 3 or 4 years before me, but Daniel Kitson is the kind of defining person doing that sort of stuff, I'd say, in my... He, as I say, not quite my generation, but it's the same crop of comedians. And if I see people now doing the sort of stuff I do, like deconstructing the joke, deconstructing the business of comedy, not in a Stuart Lee way, but in a, the sort of stuff that I do is, I suppose what I'm saying is, no, I don't think I've influenced anyone, because if you were going to be influenced by me, you might as well just be influenced by Kitson. I think, like, you can only really regard someone as being influential over the next generation of comics if they are one of the crop of people that are the sort of leaders in that field, and that's never really been me. It's a bit different in music. With bands, there are definitely like B league bands that have influenced. The Super Furry Animals, for example, one of the greatest bands, certainly of the 90s, maybe ever. They were influenced an enormous number of bands around today. They were never as famous as, say, Oasis. But it's a bit different with comedy, because with music, there is a kind of infinite scope for variety. So Super Furry is doing something no one was ever doing. So without being enormously famous, they managed to influence dozens of bands now. I've never been able to do anything that other people weren't doing. So if you're influenced by me, you're only saying you're influenced by a school of like 12 or 15 comedians. One of the blights of my career is that I've never succeeded in doing something sufficiently different from anyone else that anyone would look at me and think, I want to be like him. And I do have a sort of objective measure of this, because one of my best friends, Corey, ran the Chortle Student Awards for years, and when entering it, people had to say who their influences were. So I would obviously look at the forms. And I would come up about one out of 1,000. It was virtually all Kitson and Stuart Lee, and that's because they are the kind of they're the platonic ideals of comedians of my kind, you know. Just so being influenced like me by me would be like a supermarket wanting to be like Asda, like, you know, but they were, you know. You know, Asda, you know, Asda's not unsuccessful, but no aspiring tycoon things. I'd love to be Asda.
So just, you, funnily enough, just you mentioning the student awards reminds me of something that I heard. There is pretty much 100% failure rate on me saying to people on this show, I heard this about you. Almost every guest of mine goes, nope, never happened, don't know where it came from.
The two or three I've heard have all been wrong, definitely. Yeah.
I remember hearing at the time that one of the reasons that you won did you win the student competition?
It was the Daily Telegraph competition.
The Daily Telegraph there, you won it was that you, I hope this is true, was that you did a set that incorporated callbacks to all the other people's sets on the night.
Yeah, that's not true.
Oh, but, no, come on. like not, you know what I mean, like not necessarily written structurally ones, but just kind of, I think the reason that rang true for me was that I can sort of see that in your style, that you would be able to
it's not true, but it is true that I did, in those situations where you've only got 5 minutes, I did always used to refer to what was going on, and I think I did in that final refer to one previous set, and that's probably where that becomes inflated into a kind of extraordinary.
Yes, Watson
meta.
Sat there scribbling during everyone else's act.
Watson is a student of the game. But it was true that I used to do quite well in those kind of competitions because I would just comment freely on what had already happened, and basically and a lot of people obviously feel tied to the 5 minutes that they've planned.
Yes.
I've never really had the discipline to deliver a set routine. Even doing stuff like Live at the Apollo and stuff, I've spent a fair bit of time just talking about what we've already seen, which has been one of the reasons that I've not made huge inroads in TV, because the way they edit TV, they end up with 15 minutes of me describing an act which is being cut from the show. So I never seem to get it into my head that TV shows don't appear sequentially in the same order the other night. So normally if I do something like Live at the Apollo, my best gags will be about someone that's been on before, but when the broadcast goes out, they're on after. So probably I got a lot of credit for doing actually a very small amount of that sort of thing when I was starting out, because not many people do that in open.
You're portraying it now as if it's a weakness with regard to the competitions, with regard to the TV, but obviously it suggests a certain amount of license, a certain amount of agency on your part, that you felt you just felt sufficiently comfortable talking to an audience.
I think it was because I didn't have an enormous amount of stand-up to draw on. I was never a student of it. In those open mic competitions, I met people who had already been planning to be comedians for 3 or 4 years, and there are far more of these people coming through now as well. When I see these student competitions now, the overall level of comedy savviness and awareness of the traditions and stuff is very high. You get a lot of people that they might not have much material, but they've got all the tricks and the mannerisms. I didn't really know much about stand-up when I was going to these competitions, and I'd not been on the circuit either. Quite a lot of people enter open mic competitions having already done dozens of gigs. They've lived in London, because you can enter them for 2 or 3 years. I literally was a newcomer. I'd only ever done 4 or 5 gigs, and those were at university, so I didn't know what I was. So I didn't really have the mentality of tailoring a 5 minutes in the way that other people did, because I hadn't seen stand-up that way. So it seemed a natural thing for me to just chat about what had happened, and often there'd be an elephant in the room, because stand-up is really embarrassing when it's an open mic thing. There's 15 people there, most of them are contestants themselves, so it would be natural to me to say, "Oh, this is very awkward, isn't it?" And other people would feel they wouldn't go through to the next round if they acknowledged that. So people would play these heats as if they were in front of a sort of palladium-style crowd, whereas I would just spend the time saying, "This is desperately awkward. There's hardly any of us here, and everyone's shit." And that, you know, so I think I built my sort of successful open mic career on. I did have some material, but I think I was also popular with judges because I would happily say what everyone was thinking, which is we all wish we weren't in this situation.
Almost everything that you've said so far in the last 20 minutes has come from a place of like incredible humility about your ability, and you sort of position yourself as if you are this kind of, not, and I don't mean on stage, I kind of mean now, you position yourself as if you're sort of bumbling through it, and you don't really, I guess this sort of ended up, I suppose I was able to do this. You position yourself in a very, very low status kind of way. And I obviously you're sort of receiving compliments. There's a lot of people here to hear what you think.
It's not full, is it? It's not full.
Whenever...
Should have flied.
I feel like I do something similar about this podcast, which, like it or not, is the most successful thing I've done. Whenever I do it, when people tell me they like the show and I go, oh, thanks very much. I feel like I'm sort of similarly humble. And when I do it, it's because I feel afraid that if I go, it's fucking good, isn't it? Then somehow a shoe will drop.
Yeah. I was just all thinking about what the phrase a shoe will drop means. I think...
Don't let him get out of this. This is a good question.
There's a real sense in the room that... We all want to make up our minds whether that is a thing or not.
I took the phrase, the other shoe will drop, and I took away from that phrase, I took, as read, the fact that a first shoe had dropped.
Right, okay. Fine.
But you see my point.
Well, I'm purely just taking issue with the way that you've gone about it. Yeah. Does it come from a sort of instinct to distance myself from achievements in order to not look like a dick?
Or is it not
looking like a dick, but a worry that you're tempting fate somehow? Is that what you mean by this now infamous shoe metaphor?
Hashtag shoe metaphor, everyone at ComCom.
When this goes on Twitter, this will be huge, I think. Yeah.
But do you see what I mean? Like, you position yourself as I'm a kind of. I'm a low-status person now,
am I doing that because I worry that things will go wrong if I acknowledge that they're going well?
Because as your more recent material has included admissions of anxiety, and you talked about perhaps being a functioning alcoholic, or perhaps having been a functioning alcoholic. It's
5 o'clock.
There seems to be a lot more kind of honest stuff in your comedy these days, and a lot of that honest stuff appears to be about anxiety and angst and unhappiness in a way that there wasn't that material before. So I'm just wondering if a way into talking about that might be the fact that you maybe don't believe in yourself as a comic as much as we all think you should.
Well, yes, I don't really, and I think that kind of... I mean, it's certainly not a pose. It's difficult to unpick it because... positioning yourself low status is such a common thing, such a common trope, if you will, for a certain type of comedian that you almost expect it of people. So, most comedians instinctively will set themselves up kind of as the underdog, and that applies even to comics that are known to be millionaires and are playing enormous venues. You'll still see them.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tell stories out of which they come badly or which they, you know, so it's difficult to know at what point you're just settling into a pattern of, you know, because it'd be very odd for a person like me to be anything other than a self-facing comedian. But I think that I've definitely... I've never really felt that kind of successful or that I'm achieving what I ought to be, other than in those very early days. When your first couple of years, you can rise quite quickly as a comedian. And I think for a long time, I was sort of doing all right and reaping the benefits of it. But people always assumed that... people would always ask in interviews... Are you as kind of happy-go-lucky and crazy as you seem on stage? And I was increasingly aware that I was selling a very false version of myself. And it wasn't deliberate. I didn't think I'll try and look really kind of wacky on stage. It was just that I used stand-up as a sort of escape, I suppose, psychically. From, and I was still writing these books. All this time I was writing novels on progressively bleaker topics, but the comedy never really went into those. And once I met someone whose opinion I respected, and they said, "I've just read one of your books." This is about 5 years ago. He said, "I've just read one of your books, and I really enjoyed it." And I thought, where is that imagination on stage? I've never seen any aspects of your personality like that on stage. Why is your range of subjects so narrow? And it's true that for 4 or 5 years as a stand-up, I just basically mined a very narrow seam, or I suppose it'd be more a shallow seam, really, if we're thinking about mining accurately. Which, you know, it's important to do. If you think imprecisely about metaphors, suddenly you're chucking shoes in where they shouldn't be. So I think basically these days I'll challenge myself to get, because I was always kind of, I always had a quite jumpy, nervy personality, but I never really engaged with any of the negative aspects of my psyche on stage. I think partly because I'd got used to writing novels, and you have a kind of a 3-4 weeks, however long it takes for someone to read a novel, you have that long in the person's head. In stand-up, you've only ever got an hour, or occasionally 27, but that is an outlier. And you're conscious of a pressure to amuse people. I've seen comedians delve into really dark territory on stage and go 10, 15 minutes, really without a laugh. They're just building up stuff. They're just, you know, and I really admire that. But I've always found that very difficult to do. I've always felt that if I'm going to go into darker areas, it can't be at the expense of the audience's entertainment, because no one pays to see me kind of self-therapize. They want to see something fun. So it's only in the past couple of shows that I've given myself that license, basically. Yeah.
And in your work last night, there were something that I really admired, but it's interesting in the light of what you just said, is that you will often mention a weighty topic, and then the joke that finishes that bit is actually a joke about some other aspect of it. Like, you were talking about alcoholism. And I'm aware this is the first show this is the first attempt in the creation of a show. And we could talk about how that might develop. But you did a joke, and I sort of don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it. But you're talking about alcoholism. But the actual punchline of that bit is a joke at the moment, is a joke about sort of saying that you're not going to reveal a famous person, and then saying something which invokes who they could be.
Yeah.
So it's like the punchline isn't about alcoholism. Do you want the punchline to be about alcoholism?
Yeah, what I yearn for is to be able to take on any subject at all and just make it into comedy. And when I see the real top-level comics, or not even comics, just artists generally, that's one of the things that differentiates them from me, is that they'll just say, "I'm talking about this, I'm going to talk about it," and they'll take the audience with them. Like, a proper... if you're going to... Because even the last show was... which is my best show. I did it in Edinburgh last year. I toured with it.
This was Flaws.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it was fine. But, like, really, someone else could have done a lot better with the exact same premise. Like, the show was about being honest about my flaws, essentially. And it was about the fact that I'd never really delved into this stuff on stage. So it was a sort of coming-of-age show as a comedian. And... it was fine. Like, it went really well in terms of the... it was pretty well reviewed, as well reviewed as I'll ever be, which is pretty well, and the audiences liked it. But I was aware that I'd kind of still taken the soft options. Like, there are jokes in it which didn't really cohere, but they would get big laughs, or I would shy away from really big topics. And the most perceptive critics would say, "This is good, but it could have been better." And that is... sums me up quite well, I think. I've always really struggled to find that killer instinct for, you know, if I'm writing a book, it doesn't matter. If I'm writing a book on a specific subject, people probably don't know, but I've written a number of novels, and with those I do kind of go no holds barred, because the audience isn't in front of you, so you can sort of be as fearless as you want. Plus, no one reads the book, so it doesn't matter. But if you're in front of 200-300 people every night, it's hard to find the artistic, what's the word? Chutzpah? I don't know how you pronounce it.
Chutzpah.
It takes a certain person to really go all out in that way.
And do you aspire to do that? Do you aspire to grow that? to become that person that can that can go longer without a laugh, but get to the bottom of what it is you're saying.
I think so.
And I should say, I don't mean what I said about your show last night to be critical.
It
was funny, and you were also bringing up the subject, so we became aware of the subject.
Yeah, I'm getting there, but I will tend to, I'll always still go to a safe place if I know it's got, like, you know, and I'm like any comedian that's been going as long as I have, I'm pretty well practiced in playing the crowd for laughs, or if I'm in a slightly awkward place, you can normally get yourself out, and you have those tricks up your sleeve, but those will potentially detract from the. It's difficult because, as I say, nobody wants to see a show where you get into some sort of difficult intellectual territory, but it's not that much fun to watch. Like, I've always got an eye on that kind of laugh level, but still, the last show floors would definitely have been better if it had, say, 10% fewer laughs, and I'd gone harder on two or three of the key themes. But I just don't have the moral fibre yet to do that, I don't think. And, you know, you can imagine, like, the show sold lots of tickets, not lots of tickets, but for me, it went well on tour in Edinburgh. By any measure, it was a success. So if you've got something that's working, it is quite hard to take a punt on, do something that you think is better. But this is why if you've got genuine artistic metal of a type, which I don't think I do have, then you'll do that. The classic example, like Radiohead made Kid A after OK Computer. They'd made the best album of the decade. They knew that everyone would hate the next album if they did it the way they were going to do it. But they still did it. But that's why they're Radiohead and I'm not. Because if I'd been Radiohead after OK Computer, I'd have made an album that was a lot like OK Computer, and people would have gone, oh, you're still great. And I'd have been, thanks, guys. Radiohead made Kid A. It was panned by critics. 10 years later, everyone said, oh, this is great, actually. I don't think I have enough about me to do something which in 10 years' time people will admit was good. I need people to like it in 10 seconds' time. And that's an understandable failing, but it holds you back from making something of real lasting value, I think. Yeah.
I think, I don't know if
my,
I...
All my examples are musical, unfortunately, because I'm more into music than comedy. Sorry.
I feel like, I may be wrong, but I feel like the attitude of this room, I won't speak for everyone, I'll just speak for me, I feel like shaking you and going, why can't you admit you're a success?
I'm sorry about the tone of all this.
Yeah. It's just, like, it just seems the way you describe everything is like, oh, if I were better, I could do this. You're good. We want you to like yourself.
The trouble is, I think the thing is, because occasionally I have a moment where I think, why can't I sort of accept, you know, where I'm... I think the thing is that... I don't know, this is going to sound terrible, but if I was working for UNICEF or something and I was like the 18th best person, I'd think, still, what I'm doing is so intrinsically valuable that I'm proud to just be a part of it. But comedy, I'm not saying it's not important, but stand-up is kind of a slightly narcissistic or insular thing to do. Of course, it's important for people to have a good time. Like, entertainment's important. I'm not saying that there's no value to it, but it's quite an egocentric thing to do, I think. So to justify it, I think I'd want to be the absolute best at it. But also, I think whatever I did, I'd want to be the absolute best at. If I were a snooker player or tennis player or something where they have rankings and I was like number 72... I wouldn't be able to help thinking, well, how do I get into the top 10? And it's basically that. If there were rankings for comedians, I'd be, like, in the UK rankings, I'd be, like in the 50s or 60s. And it's human nature to think, well, how do I get into the 30s and 20s? You can't not, I don't think. As long as there are people better than you, I think it's natural to want to push yourself towards. And the difference is with writing... I would be nowhere in the rankings. But there are thousands of better writers, but writers write books for the whole of a lifetime. Like, writing novels is a craft which you develop over 50 years. So it doesn't bother me that authors in their 60s are a lot more accomplished than me. I feel I can grow into that. As a stand-up, I feel like there are people that just naturally better. Of course, it's really unhealthy to compare yourself to people.
Well, it is.
I think there's a poem or something about it. There's that thing you get on toilet doors that says there'll always be someone better than you or worse than you, so that's fine. It's a prayer. But it's just...
Can you be happy, though, if you're always comparing yourself? Like,
I don't think so, no.
The thing,
when do we start talking about that?
The thing I always fall back on thinking in that situation is, like, you know, Ricky Gervais probably wants to be a Hollywood leading man.
It's
true.
I mean,
no matter what you've got, you want the thing above it. You want to be in the top 10 of the new category that you've just sought out.
It's true. There's people having a better time even in this building. Like, small wonder that you can pay yourself to. Yeah, it's not. I should make it clear that when you talk about, like, I don't look at, say, Michael McIntyre or Jimmy Carr and think, I wish I was selling that many tickets or was that. It's purely when my disappointments are all to do with feeling like I haven't achieved what I could, or just feeling like I wish I was actually better at it. I'm not jealous of other people's. I'm not constantly looking at someone saying, why has he got a TV show or why is she, you know, it's about artistic level you want to reach rather than kind of commercial success. Because it would be, I'd be whinging if I said, oh, I don't have a good time. Obviously, at the level I'm at, I tour, I sell plenty of tickets, I make a good living out of doing something which is a lot less onerous than most people's jobs. So I'm not, I'd hate it if all of this ended up sounding like I was complaining about my lot in life. It's not that, it's just that I think it's natural to want to aspire to be the best that you can. And while, so maybe it's not even about other people, it's just I want to be the best that I can, and I don't think I've reached that, but I'm not quite sure how to get to that level either. But it's certainly true that there's hardly anyone in comedy or in any branch of entertainment that doesn't look at someone else and think, why isn't that me? As you say, even Gervais will be, sure, there'll have been disappointments, there'll have been things he didn't get. So there's no future in looking at things thinking, why haven't I done that? Mm. It's just, it's natural to do that, I think.
I want to talk a bit more about the craft of particularly, not just the jokes, but the shows. Because something I remember when I supported you on tour in something like 2007?
Not 8? Something like 2007.
Oh, you're good with dates, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I am, yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, it was exactly like 2007. Yeah.
How many letters were in the word hieroglyph?
10.
That's very suspicious.
That's a thing
quick
I can do. They're all doing it in their head, but you'll find it's 10.
Yeah.
I've got an absolutely useless skill where I can just say, tell you how many letters are in the word.
Yeah,
it's useful if someone else is doing a crossword and it's like 9 letters.
I remember Kanji.
And they'll say something like, you know, calligraphy, and you're like, no, it's not 9, is it? But
I remember casually referring to you as being on the spectrum as a result of that. You're getting quite cross.
Yeah, spectrum.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously 8, but yeah.
When something I noticed, I remember from that show, was that you got you explained in the show, structurally, at the beginning of the show, that at 40 minutes there would be a lull, such as there always is in a comedy show. So at 40 minutes, could you get, you'd pick someone from the audience, get you with the timer, can you start chanting lull, lull, at the 40-minute lull?
That's right, yeah.
It was a really funny idea, which also perfectly sewed up the actual real 40-minute lull, or the possibility of a real 40-minute lull.
Yeah, you, beautifully handled.
You've done, you have a similar device regarding encores.
Yeah, I've never done that before until last night, but yeah. Right.
But you seem to have a real degree of fluency with coming up with little things. Do you mean like a really smart approach to the actual real challenges, say, of the structure of a show? I remember also one of the shows you toured in 2000 and around then 7 or 8, I can't remember because I did both, was the 7 Deadly Sins one, where you would have chunks of material on 7 different things and get audience members to pull things out of a bag such that it was in a different order every night. So with ideas like that, at what point in the process do those ideas occur?
Well, I'm always trying to take the pressure off the audience a bit. I think I do things like the lull, or last night we had a kind of a scheduled encore, like halfway through the show, purely to sort of raise everyone's collective spirits. And because I always think that the mistake people make when they think, God, it must be really difficult to do comedy, is they assume that the audience is hostile. So people will always ask you, how do you deal with hecklers? How do you deal with difficult audience? But there was one dick in the crowd last night. But the majority of audiences want to have a good time as much as you want them to have a good time. So things like the lull that happens about 40 minutes in, or awkward moments that come about, they're the responsibility of you and the audience jointly to work together against, I think. And I do like to create the sense that you and the audience are all in the same boat, not out of some sort of smarminess, because I genuinely believe it. I believe that everyone does want the show to go well. And so I will. I'm forever coming up with gimmicks to break down the difficulty of an hour is a long time for people to laugh at just one man talking. If there are ways you can address that and undermine it, and in doing that, address some of the problems of it, I'll do it. But those ideas can come at different times. With that thing with the Seven Deadly Sins thing, it came about very late. I had a show that was working reasonably well, but something was just wrong. I would talk about each of the Seven Deadly Sins in turn with jokes, and just something. I was doing previews, and the show was just like most of my shows, just very, very competent, but not exciting. But unlike most of my shows, I managed to crack the problem. I thought, well, what if the sins always came in a different order? And so very late, like 3 days before Edinburgh, I thought, we'll just do it in a different order every night. I'll just randomise the order of the seven subjects and get the audience to dictate the order of the show. Because I knew that I had the material. It would just mean that every show was a little bit different. Mm. And that simple idea transformed the show, because it meant I never knew which bit of the show was coming next, which meant that I was more sort of mentally alert. But those ideas can come, really late in the process. Even when I'm very familiar with the show, I'm always looking to sort of tinker with the structure in a way that can... Because you do, especially in Edinburgh, or even a festival like this, people see a lot of the one-hour show. Mm. So you see most of what can be done. You see most possible approaches, most possible subjects. If there's anything I can do to surprise an audience or in some way change the structure or the approach, I'll try and do it. And the most extreme example of that is these 24-hour shows. A lot of the reason I do those is because that's one thing that's mine that other people aren't doing. Yes. And whether it's good or not, at least it's my idea, and the format is something that other people aren't doing unless I do it.
I wanted to come on to that, because you did mention, when you mentioned that sense that we're all in this together, it was quite clear, I remember from seeing some of the very... I don't think I saw the first one, but the second year you did the 24-hour show, it was clear that the game was, we're all in this together and we all have to fill the time together.
Yeah,
and so you get to captain this ship full of people, heroic people that want to make something happen where there was nothing.
Yeah, and in the long shows, that is very obvious because people are undergoing physical suffering. But that in miniature is even how I feel about a one-hour show, really, or a theatre-length show, 2 hours, however long it is. I do feel like... Of course, you're at the helm, but everyone can cooperate to make it a good time. So that if there are people shouting stuff out, I will try and accommodate them rather than just attack them, because my default position is always to assume that everyone wants to have fun. Yeah, the marathon shows are an extreme example, because there is a tangible sense that we all need to work together or people will lose the will to live. But that can happen even in a very short-form comedy show. So, yeah, I do think... I think the comedian has not exactly a responsibility, but kind of a mandate from the audience to do whatever's necessary. We all work together to do it. You should come away from a comedy show feeling that, not necessarily that you've had to work or that you've contributed, but that the comedian's done everything possible to give you a good time while you're in that building.
Given that you're the captain of that ship and you're the person who has to remain responsible for it the whole time, and you, no matter how many lieutenants you've got, you need to be the person who is undergoing the most hardship. No matter how many times Tiernan Duyeb has his back shaved, you need to be the person who is kind of doing the most suffering, almost. Like, you're the person that's bearing, you're Atlas holding the globe.
That's how I see myself, basically. Yeah.
And so I was going to ask, what sort of state creatively do you end up in? Are there moments within 27 hours? And given that you've done a few of them, do you feel things like, well, any minute now I'm going to hit the hour 9 endorphin rush, or I'm going to, round about hour 14, something, I'm going to be getting really pie-eyed, and normally something extra creative happens then? Or...
Yeah, you do become like a veteran marathon runner. You sort of know how 20-odd hours feels psychologically, so you expect certain kind of highs and lows, and it is true that you have to, the shows only work because I, as you say, I remain kind of the person that's in the most trouble. If there was a sense that I could just hand over to someone for 2 or 3 hours, then there'd be no jeopardy at all. I have to be, I think creatively you're in quite an odd state by the end of it, because you've set up so many things during the show that Your mind is like a kind of pin board with dozens and dozens of post-it notes on it. There's always so much unfinished business at the end of these shows. So you, in a sense, you're kind of creatively hyper-stimulated because your brain has been in this adrenalized state for 20-odd hours and you never really switch off from it. So in a way, it is the most creatively alive you ever can be, because for 20-odd hours, your brain has been racing with the challenge of keeping people interested, but also you're really tired. So I would liken it to being like a pleasantly drunk or something. Quite often if you're drunk, or people talk like this about recreational drugs as well, I've never really done this, but people will often say that under the influence of this or that, you'll have ideas that you're certain are great ideas, and then in the light of day, they're not so good. There's a lot of that in the 27-hour shows. You feel kind of like a genius, but you're also aware that the next day, you'll feel like a tired, weird man. And
there's something of those shows in which I've seen or participated or been an audience member in, there seem to be kind of several different types of audience member. You go, people within the room, there'll be celebrity pals that are helping you, there'll be kind of non-higher profile, you know, less lower profile comedians who are involved some way. I'll include myself in that, playing Animal Verb, for example, in the last one, which...
You bought us a whole hour.
I mean, that was, yeah. That was a lot of fun. There'll also be kind of what I would think of as kind of regular punters. And then you seem to attract a high level of the sort of die-hard comedy super fans who stay with you, who kind of want to come and see every single one of those shows.
Yeah, I think the nature of it, of a 25 or 27-hour show, is inevitably it will attract people that think, that like the challenge of being there for that long, or that genuinely are so into comedy that they can't think of anything better than being in a room with comedians for a day. But I've always been quite grateful that... I was talking about this recently. I think most comedians have a sort of... most comedians of any profile have... You'll get a contingent of super fans, not your own super fans, but just people that are very, very into comedy. But I'm always quite sort of grateful that the people, that even the most extreme fans that I have, are still pretty normal functioning people. Whereas if you go up a couple of levels of fame from me, you start to get people who it's not quite right. And I've seen it. I've seen it myself. I mean, I inherited a lot of fans from Tim Minchin because of the stuff I did with him in my early career. But the people that migrated, they didn't migrate to me because they never abandoned. No one ever leaves the Minchin ship. But the fans that I ended up sharing with Minchin tended to be the kind of the more soft core end of his fan base, people that are into comedy but aren't using it to cover up gigantic problems. Somebody like Tim, and Minchin is only the example I use because he's a good friend of mine, so I'm conversant with his fan base. But there are certainly a lot of top level comedians who acquire a fan base of people who, and I don't, despite the callous way I said that, I don't have disdain for these people at all, because we're all propped up by the fact that people love comedy and they want to see it. So however into comedy someone is, that's absolutely fine with me, and I tend to be, as comedians go, as respectful of fans as possible, I think, because I'm really grateful for them. But it's definitely true that some people just do get a bit too into it, and I don't think I have those fans, really. Even the most mad people that come to my shows are still people that like could open a bank account and it'd be fine. Yeah, like...
We were talking a little bit earlier on about the Stuart Lee incident, and the kind of what I want to ask about is the fallout of what happened 5 years ago with the advert. Was it 5 years ago?
Six years
ago, whereby two of the most foremost kind of outspoken voices in comedy, Stuart Lee and Frankie Boyle, both basically had some manner of pop at you for doing an advert. And I know you've spoken about that a lot since, but I kind of want to just... I'm just wondering what the long-term ramifications of that are, and whether it... Given that we now know from your work that you suffer from anxiety and angst and things like that, whether some of that's responsible, whether you feel that hangs over you, or whether you feel you were able to deal with it and move on.
Well, the first thing I should say is that I never really... I definitely did underestimate how much people would care about it. Like, because I don't pay any attention to adverts at all. I'm aware that like, there are loads of much more famous people than me that do adverts, and I myself would never judge them for it, or even associate them with that brand, because I think I'm virtually impervious to adverts. And I sort of feel like most people are, really. Like, I don't, especially now, you don't ever need to watch adverts, really, because of the way TV works now. It wasn't the case in 2009. So, but also, the advert, which was, in case anyone doesn't know, was for Pear Cider, was, as really innocuous stuff, an innocuous brand. The content of the advert was very... There was really nothing controversial about it. And by contrast, there was nothing that I felt that undermined my myself as a comedian, because I hadn't built a career on saying, cider is shit, no one should drink it. And it seems really naive now, but when I was offered the advert, I didn't think people might judge me for this. I certainly didn't think there would be people that enjoyed my comedy that would feel in some way cheated by the fact that I'd... And to be honest, I don't think there were either. The criticism came... I wasn't aware of anyone criticising me who... I never met anyone that said, I used to like your comedy, but now you've tried to advertise pear cider, I don't like it anymore. Because I don't think that's a logical standpoint to have. I mean, Stephen Fry's done loads of adverts without anyone ever... So... But yeah, there was. I mean, Stuart Lee never kind of he never addressed it with me, or but he'd started doing a bit of his show about it. It's a weird way to find out that you've fallen out of favour with Stuart Lee, is for people to start talking about a great routine about you that he's got, and it did affect me partly because the Frankie Boer thing was separate. I sort of asked for trouble there because I got into a spat with him over some of his material. And that was a different situation. With Stuart, nobody wants to be criticised by Stuart Lee because he does have this position as the kind of moral compass of comedy. And not even moral, just the compass of comedy. He pretty much seems to get to say whether anyone's funny or not. And his power over the comedians is extraordinary. So I didn't... But also, I partly felt undermined by it because I felt that it was probably true. If somebody says that you're a dick for doing an advert, a part of you can't help thinking, yeah, I guess I probably am. Because there's no denying that I'd done it for the money. There was various mitigating circumstances. Like there was an ambitious novel I wanted to write. It took a year to do it. I knew I'd have to not do much comedy. The advert pretty much paid for that. So I did do it with an eye to sort of furthering my artistic and so on. But still... It's very hard to counter the accusation that you're a sellout for doing an advert. I did sort of feel that if I was Stuart Lee, I wouldn't be talking about a lesser comedian. And I do feel that sometimes with him, that there's kind of... It feels like a cheap shot if it's criticising somebody that is already less famous than you for doing something they've done in order to acquire success. So I don't know. I felt any, but mostly I felt weird about it because I'd never ever, I'm such a sort of uncontroversial figure that I'd never rubbed up anyone the wrong way before. I'd never been in a beef, or I don't think even Jay-Z had anything against me. It's a very, very weird feeling to be criticised by people with, and the Frankie Boer thing was much more difficult to deal with because he has such a big outspoken online following that I had an awful lot of like hate tweets and hate, actual hate mail and stuff as well, so that was worse. But in both cases, I think what was odd for me was just I know this sounds kind of disingenuous or like false modesty, but I genuinely never thought anyone would give a shit whether I advertised cider or not. But if I could have my time again, I think I'd still do it, because I don't think any of the criticism was sufficiently damning to make me think I shouldn't have done that. It just made me think I'm going to need to prepare myself for criticism. In a way, it was a good exercise to be harshly criticised by my peers. It's just no one likes that at the time. And I've never had the same... Before that, I'd gotten very well with Stuart. When you find out someone's basing a portion of their stand-up show on you being a dick, it does change things a bit. And
Have you spoken to him about it in person?
We've never discussed it. You have to get a permit to speak to Stuart now. And...
you must presumably do a lot of festivals at which he's present.
Yeah.
Do you make eye contact?
I see him all the time and we speak civilly. Not Frankie Boyle. I've never met Frankie Boyle since this high-profile falling out. And if I did, it would be difficult. But Stuart, I kind of... I think I sort of accept that he gets to say what he likes and you just have to still get
but you've
on
never,
him.
And you've never addressed it. You've never said, hey, should we no, do you want a coffee and let's talk about it?
I haven't, partly because he seems like someone that probably would disapprove of all the coffee chains that you get. Yeah, I'd need to find one that was definitely... I don't go to Starbucks, like, I'm not an idiot, but I still think you'd probably have to... No, because also I sort of... I've seen the bit that he does about it, and it is kind of derisory rather than actually aggressive. Frankie was aggressive. He actually... He said various quite hurtful things. Stuart was just kind of damning in the way that he's damning about comedians that have fallen short of a very high moral bar that he sets. So I suppose I take solace in the fact that I'm not the only person to have disappointed him. And also, I mean, I like him actually as a guy, but I think if we had coffee, it would be pretty awkward. Because
do you want a kind of closure on it? Or have you just, do you not think about it, it's dealt with?
Do you know what? With the Stuart Lee thing, I don't really mind it because it's dealt with in the sense that I don't think he talks about it on stage anymore. I don't think he spends much time thinking about me anymore. He himself will have probably forgotten all this. The Frankie Boyle thing, I would like closure for, but I don't think I can have it because I don't think I can ever...
It's hard to imagine him apologising.
Yeah, and there's nothing I can do that can repair that. I don't like to go through life with a sense of any psychic unpleasantness that's not been clear. Basically what happened, in case anyone doesn't know, was that I wrote a blog taking the view that comedians should try not to be offensive, which is unfashionable. These days, a lot of comedians are in the business of saying, we should talk about whatever we like. It's meant to be comedy. If you don't like it, don't come. And I just wrote a blog saying that is not quite true because of YouTube and stuff. If you do a joke about fat people or whatever it might be, there are two or three million people see that. The defense of, like, if you don't like it, don't watch comedy doesn't really apply anymore because comedy is now so successful that it infiltrates our social discourse, and it has the opportunity to affect stereotypes and assumptions in a way that it never had before, which I still think is a valid point. But unfortunately, as my example, I used the fact that Frankie Boyle had a go at people with Down syndrome in his show, or a specific person with Down syndrome, and the standard defence that he used was, well, you shouldn't be there unless you expect... But I hadn't been at the show, and I hadn't seen what happened, and so I didn't really have the right to do that. I used him without knowing the full facts of it. But again, I did that, thinking, well, if Frankie ever hears about this, he's not going to care. Because if you're a comedian that prides himself on being massively offensive... Or perhaps he doesn't pride himself on that, but he certainly allows himself license to say what the hell he likes about anyone. And he's four or five rungs up the comedy ladder from me, so I just didn't think he'd ever care. And at the time, he didn't even know about it. The blog came out, and there was no reaction to it. But like a year and a half later, somebody sent it to him, and suddenly he went into it, and he called me all these things, and he said that I had done this advert, I had no status, and all this kind of thing. And that was harder to deal with, because my instinct was just to try and repair the damage and, you know, say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean... But I don't think I'm in a position to ever do that with him, because, as you say, he's never going to... I don't even want him to apologise. I would just like to meet him and for him to say, let's just forget about that. But I don't imagine he even feels like being conciliatory about it, because it doesn't seem like he's the sort of bloke to do that. So that's a regret. I don't know what I can do about that, really. I don't like going through life feeling that somebody dislikes me to that extent, but... And if it was a case of... hugging it out, I'd do it at a venue of his choosing. But I suspect I'm going to have to accept that I can't ever make that right. Yeah.
We've been given a few extra minutes. If anyone does have a question, then feel free to put a hand up. Come on, Mark. You're in Wales. Explain why you pretended to be Welsh.
It's fair enough, yeah. No, you asked it very...
Sorry, I've
you've made it
unfaithfully
into a fight. Yeah,
represented that. I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, yeah, basically it was that it made me more comfortable to have a sort of a persona, because when I started out, I thought, I really want to do this, but it would be very awkward to be just standing there talking, which is what puts most people off, the idea of doing stand-up. You think, you imagine your own voice, it sounds really loud. Oh, it's horrible. A lot of aspects of doing stand-up are quite sort of creepy, really. So I thought, and I knew I'd had Welsh family, I could do a Welsh accent. I had done a Welsh character in a show at university, so I knew that I could, and it suited my persona quite well. But it wasn't a strategy. It was just something I did in those early gigs, because the gigs were 5 minutes long, and I felt like it didn't matter. Then it became successful, and I had accidentally carved a niche for myself as that Welsh guy. I was pretty much forced to carry it on. And for a couple of years, I did it, and I would be in people's cars on the way back from the gig, still going, yeah, it went well, I reckon. It was a little bit tough at the end, but it's not too bad.
You'd keep it up off stage.
Because I thought
comments.
They would think I was a liar if I... Yeah. So I remember driving back from Blackpool 6 hours to keeping the accent up, and I started thinking, I'm not sure this is sustainable, really.
Did you ever run into any of those comics, like the comic from the Blackpool car journey? Did you ever see them again and have to go, oh, by the way?
I was aware that cracks were beginning to appear in the story, yeah. and one of the problems was of Rod as well. Rod was one of my counterparts in that group of comedians, and he's kept it going for a lot longer than me, the way I was playing. Like, he... I'm starting to think he's only got one trick in his... partly, I felt guilty because he and I would do a lot of gigs together, and he would always... whoever went on second would always do less well because the Welsh thing had been done. And I would think, oh, I shouldn't really have done that because the Welsh thing is really his. But also, just pragmatically, it was starting to get difficult because I would do a Radio 4 interview or because I had this other career writing books. And increasingly, I was appearing in situations where I couldn't go into character because I was just doing something like this, for example. So there came a point where I thought, I can't... It's not a situation like Al Murray where... he could potentially do that character forever. I'm not going to be able to put on an accent for the rest of my life. Plus, I was aware that if I could free myself from it, I would be better as a stand-up because I would just have more... I'd be more relaxed on stage. So I definitely felt better as a result of having dropped it. But I do miss it as a sales pitch because there's no doubt it was really useful. As the time when I was, oh, you're that Welsh guy, was I've never had a hook quite as noticeable as that since then.
Almost every interview you've done, I'm sure, someone has said, what's your advice for new comics? And the advice that everyone gives, and I've seen you give on, you know, on interviews before, is to just keep gigging. I think that's a go-to thing that everyone agrees with.
But apart from that?
Apart from that, yeah. I'm just kind of wondering, what's the second piece of advice you'd give? I just want to get slightly, as a last thing, underneath the skin of maybe what something that you wish you'd done sooner or that you wish you'd done differently.
I think that a lot of people now come through as new comics and feel the pressure to do the sort of stuff they see other people doing because there's much more of an archive of stand-up now than there was 10 years ago. And stand-up's on the TV the whole time. There are a lot of people to compare yourself with, as we've said. So I think I'd say always try and do something that you yourself believe is funny rather than something that you think the market requires. I see quite a lot of up-and-coming comics that, as I've said earlier in this interview, that are really accomplished, they've got great skills, they've got observations, they've got the whole package, but there's just a lingering sense that they're doing what they think comedians do rather than what they think is funny. Whereas, well, to give one example, he's just left, but Tim Key, who's a good friend of mine, is somebody who has always done purely what he intended to do without any concessions to the kind of prevailing fashion in comedy. And for a good number of years, people thought he was just an idiot. I think if you're doing something which is funny and has integrity, it'll eventually be recognised. And a lot of the comedians that I admire most are people who are doing stuff that, for a long time, people just didn't like it. Paul Foote, Tim Key, Sam Simmons. To a lesser extent, O'Doherty was always quite successful, but there are a lot of comedians I think are brilliant who they've had to struggle through that bar, that wall of people thinking, this is a bit weird for me. Eventually, if it's funny, it will find its audience. So I think my advice to someone starting out would be, yeah, pursue what you think is funny, not what you think the expectation is. Because in the end, there's an awful lot of people doing generic stand-up well, but unexcitingly. But there's only a handful of people doing something that actually makes you think, wow, that's brilliant. And those are normally people who started out thinking, nearly everyone will hate this, but a few people will love it. That's what you should probably try and aim for.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. Mark Watson.
So that was Mark. Thank you very much to Mark for coming on and for being so candid. I've been really looking forward to that interview, and I really think he gave the most of himself, and I felt like we got some very honest answers. He was, if you were there, you'll remember, he was twizzling his beard furiously, which certainly to me was some sort of a tell that he was being very, very open. So thank you, Mark. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you very much to... now, who else do I need to thank? Of course, Olivia Phipps for her occasional podmin. No, I haven't asked her to do any recently, but it's nice to remind you all of her contribution of previous episodes. So thank you to Nathan Wood, who co-produces this show. And thank you to Mark Dawson, who recently did some photographs for me at the Nina Conti podcast, which I'll be using on the new website. I'll tell you all about that when we're going to launch it. Next week, live from the Tallinn Comedy Festival, we've got Mitch Benn. That was recorded a couple of weeks ago. And then we've got an extra special, very, very exciting guest coming up, who's coming around to my flat in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, hashtag get me Jackie Chan. I've had an amazing opener. Yesterday I sent an email to Jackie via Jackie's manager, via an artist who's recently worked with Jackie, via a listener who knows the artist. This is exactly how this shit should work, ladies and gentlemen. So I have emailed something which may or may not be read by Jackie, or read to Jackie, or translated for Jackie. So one of you I know on the podcast Facebook page did point out that they wondered how good my Mandarin was, seeing as Jackie's English is not as good as people suspect. I thought he was fluent in English, or at least fluent in, you know, decent English, or maybe good at English. Maybe I'll get Des Bishop to translate for us. So, hashtag get me Jackie Chan. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget, the Comedian's Comedian podcast is not a substitute for actually doing some of your own writing. Get to it. I'll speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.